Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, November 23rd, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. Today's actually my mom's birthday. Happy birthday, Mom. I don't know if you listen to the podcast, but if you do, I'm saying it again to you. All right, guys, we have a great show today featuring Raquel Nuno. She is a graduate student at the University of California, Los Angeles, and we'll be talking about SciComm and water on Mars and on the moon, and also cool stuff about just her awesome life and the sort of non-traditional path that she took to get there. But beforehand, I want to give a shout out to a handful of people. As usual, this week's episode of Talk Nerdy is brought to you by you. Specifically, I want to thank Elena Scott, Phil Tebear, and Timothy Glover, along with Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. I also want to give a special thank you this week to Warren Rogers, and also Juan, no last name Juan, and Oscar Ibarra on the Patreon portal. That's at www.patreon.com/talknerdy, where each of those individuals, along with many others, are making episodic pledges to support the show. Over on the PayPal portal, I want to thank this week Todd Erickson. Thank you guys all so much from the bottom of my heart. Without you, Talk Nerdy would not be possible, and it definitely wouldn't be free to download on iTunes and Stitcher. All right, guys, without any further ado, here she is, a super, super cool chick, and my friend, Raquel Nuno. Raquel, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
I am excited to chat with you, mostly because I know you, but I don't know you that well. And I like getting to know people on air. It's a weird experiment thing, fun time.
It's exciting, right?
It's exciting, yeah. And also, we recently did an audio workshop together at SciComm Camp, which I think I mentioned in the intro to the show last week or the week before, a fun group of science communicators who got together to talk about science communication. In Malibu. And so we got to spend the weekend together and get to know each other a bit more. But of course, we also spent the weekend with like 49 of our closest friends. So that's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, not a lot of 101.
Yeah. And you were there with some with two other women from UCLA. You're a student at UCLA in the graduate program, the graduate program, in one of their many graduate programs. And you were there along with two other students who are working on improving science communication there, right?
Yeah, that's right. So me and Laura and Amanda, that's the three of us. We actually met up at a meetup group. Scientists and an artist meetup group are all really interested in science communication. We thought there's not a lot of training for grad students who are interested in science communication, and we figured let's get together and try to come up with a workshop. Maybe we can help others and learn it ourselves along the way. And so with the three of us, created an 8-week workshop at UCLA for other grad students. And then we heard about your workshop, the retreat, the camp retreat, which was amazing, where we could actually talk to professionals and learn from professionals, whereas we've just been learning on the way and learning along with the other grad students as well. So it was a great experience.
That's really what the professionals are doing. Like, I'm going to put that in air quotes. Like, Jason and I were just talking about it today. We're doing a post, kind of a post-mortem on SciComm Camp. And we were saying it's going to be interesting to do a survey afterward to see where people are in their SciComm careers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, is this a career? Is it something you do for fun? Is it something you do part-time? Because he was like, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if sort of we were the more seasoned people. And then he was like, which is crazy because, like, we're not seasoned at all. Like, we're all just, like, stumbling through this together. But your group, what are you guys called?
We're the SciComm Hub at UCLA. Yeah, nice. So Amanda and Laura, they started the SciComm Hub International. So it's a website where they gather all this information about science communication, resources for everyone, job opportunities. And then the three of us, we started the workshop at UCLA.
That's huge. I mean, that's really helpful because I think a lot of people who I get this question a lot in my inbox, kind of like, how did you get to do what you do? Like, what do I do if I want to do your job? And it's like, I don't know, you know? Sometimes people have these really non-traditional routes until they kind of find themselves in places. And so it's definitely good to have resources available for people who are on that track. But also, like you said, you're doing these workshops for graduate students because it's becoming more and more apparent that if you want to be a professional scientist, you need to know how to talk about your science.
And there's not a lot of resources for that. We are not taught how to talk. We're not taught how to, just especially to the public. Yeah, we're taught how to do talks at conferences, but that's very different when you're trying to communicate to the public, especially, and I think that's really important for the bigger issues like climate change and things like that, where it's important for like vaccines. We want to be able to communicate to people who don't have science backgrounds. And it's a very, very different style of communication. And a lot of students don't know that science communication is a thing.
Yeah.
They have no idea. That's a thing? Like, that's what I wanted to do. That's what I'm interested in. I didn't know there was a name.
Yeah.
So we're really trying to spread the word that you can get better at this. You can get a job at this and you can learn.
I think that's great. Yeah. I think you're so right that when I first started doing this, I was working at probably HuffPost was my first like professional sort of institutional job. And but I've done other freelancy work and other more professional TV things since. But probably that's where I first learned the ropes. And I remember going to a science communication conference. And before I went, I literally thought I was the only person that did what I do for a living. Like I was like, oh, I invented a new field, you know? And it's like, oh my God, what? But I bet you a lot of people find themselves, man, I'm like the only, I got to reinvent the wheel. It's like, no, you don't. Like there are a lot of people doing this. We can all learn from each other, which is helpful.
Yeah. And I think it's nice to see that there is a community and super helpful community who want, you want to help all the other science communicators.
Yeah. That's one thing that I really liked about SciComm Camp is that there were people that came who nobody knew. You know what I mean? They were new to the group. They didn't know. Maybe they had met some people online, but they had never met anybody else there in person. And at least from, at least hopefully, and from what we gathered, and we'll see more when we get these kind of surveys back, people seemed really comfortable. It's like, oh, it's my people.
Yeah.
I love it. Don't you love it when you find your people?
Yeah, you do.
It's so fun. And it's hard in LA. I've talked about that a lot on the show before. How when I first moved to LA, I remember it being like, oof. It's a rough place to meet my people, but eventually I found this great group of friends, the Nerd Brigade, who in somehow or another, a lot of the people that I do spend time with and a lot of people that have been on the podcast are like allied with the Nerd Brigade.
Right,
Because you're friends with almost all of those.
Them, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of them came. So your story, though, to me is really interesting because you're a graduate student at UCLA. You're working on your PhD. We're around the same age. Can I say that on air?
Yeah.
Okay. You don't have to say exactly how old you are, but everybody knows how old I am. So we'll just say we're around the same age. And you are entrenched. You are deeply in your educational process, but you're still towards the beginning of your PhD.
That's right.
And the reason for that is that you've had like this whole amazing life before you went to school, which I think is always really fun to hear about.
Yeah, it's been sort of a winding, crazy path, but ended up exactly where I always thought I would end up.
Really?
Which is kind of insane, yeah. I always wanted to be a scientist. As a little kid, it's totally cliche, but I've always wanted to be a scientist. But I didn't go straight into science right after high school, and that was because my father was ill with cancer, and we weren't U.S. citizens at the time.
So you were living here?
I was living here in the United States.
Where in the U.S.?
In Rhode Island and then New Jersey.
Okay, so you were like East Coast.
You were
when you were in high school, you were not a citizen.
Right.
Did you, were you guys illegal?
No, we were legal.
You were legal. Okay.
Yeah, so like, I had a sponsor. One of our, we had a family friend who took me on as a, she sponsored me to be here and study here. So I was on a student visa. But my parents were, they were both artists. They're non-scientists. So they both painted and they had their own business. But because we weren't U.S. citizens, we couldn't get like Medicaid or Medicare.
Gotcha.
And at the time, it was terminal cancer my dad had, and we couldn't afford the medicine anymore. Uh-huh. And I was 17 years old. I was graduating high school, and I'm like, what am I going to do? I need to help my family. I'm an only child. My parents have always done everything for me. I need to give back somehow.
So had you, before the diagnosis, had you thought, you know, oh, I'm going to go to college.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to follow a normal.
Yep.
And then do you remember when he was first diagnosed?
Yeah, I was 16.
Okay, so that's when you started to rethink your plans.
Yeah, yeah, and it was natural for me to mm-hmm. make that decision. It was a very tough decision for me to make, but it just seemed like that's what I had to do.
It was like family. You couldn't do you had to.
I had
to. There's no question.
There was no question. And that was totally fine in my mind. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to join the military. So I went to the Air Force. I was 17 years old. My 18th birthday was in basic training.
Really? I didn't know you could start when you were 17.
Yeah, if you get your parents to approve.
Oh, nice. And so was the idea, this is how I can make money, or is there some sort of citizenship angle to that?
So the idea started out with, I can make money. This mm-hmm. is the only way. I don't have any skills, really.
Yeah, you're just graduating high school.
What am I going to do? So I could get skills. And then lots of other things came out of my military experience that I didn't expect. So once you're in the military, if you have a parent that's sick, mm-hmm. you can make them a dependent of yours, which means that they're able to get care provided for by the military.
So like VA hospitals and things like that?
Military hospitals. I worked in a hospital, and so my dad was there when he was sick, and we were able to get end-of-life medicine for him, which was costing us $1,100 every 10 days.
Oh, my God.
Back in the day. Yeah. Because he couldn't work. He couldn't work mm-hmm. when he was sick, and so we couldn't afford health insurance. So.
And they were artists already, which
right.
is kind of a non-traditional.
Yep.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah, yeah. So you joined the Air Force. You turned 18 during basic training.
Mm-hmm.
And then after basic, or is it before basic, that you take the test where it tells you, like, what kind of job you're going to do?
Oh, yeah. This is before.
Okay.
This is before. So when you go, you take it's the ASVAB. Mm-hmm. I don't remember exactly what it stands for. But it tests your math skills, your administrative skills. There's mechanical skills. And I got a really high score. I could have gotten any job I wanted in mm-hmm. the military, but because I wasn't a U.S. citizen, I couldn't get any of the cool jobs.
Ah, what a bummer.
Like
they prioritize those for people who are born here?
Yeah. Because you have to be able to get clearance. And if you don't have citizenship, you can't get
like security clearance?
Yeah, security clearance.
Oh.
Yeah. So how I ended up picking my job, because I've always been a total nerd, I'm like, what's going to give me the biggest challenge? So I picked the job that required the highest test scores, because I figured that will probably be the most interesting thing that I can do.
Yeah, it'll be the hardest job.
Yeah, exactly.
And what was it?
Medical laboratory technology.
Okay.
So I got to play with blood, urine, poop. Yeah, that's what I did for 4 years in the military. I tested people's body fluids for diseases and things like that.
Well, what a great way to kind of go into the science and medical sort of allied fields before you've even had any – I mean, I shouldn't say before you've had training. You get your training in the military. But before you've had what we think of as kind of traditional civilian training.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, okay, so you're very young. Your father is not doing well.
Mm-hmm.
You decide to go for this medical job, this laboratory technician job, and do you have to leave home, or you do?
Yeah, I leave home. But while I was in, so I did basic training, and then after basic training, there's tech training. That's where you get trained for your job.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's hands-on training. After you do your basic classroom training, you have to actually go to the laboratory and do the work, and that's also considered training. And it was while I was in that phase two in the laboratory training that I was able to make my dad a dependent of mine. And so I was in Virginia at Langley Air Force Base at the time, and mm-hmm. he moved down, and he was living with me, and they allowed me to move off base, and they gave me a stipend for housing.
Oh, wow. And this was all pretty soon after all of your training. So
yes,
it's like you had
super soon.
You had shown commitment by mm-hmm. enlisting and by going through, at this point, how many weeks would that have been?
So it was actually longer than weeks. So I went into basic training in July. And
what's that, 8 weeks?
It was 6.5 weeks.
6.5? Okay, at the so
time.
A month and a half.
Uh-huh. At the time, there. So I think it's double now. So I got lucky.
Yeah, wow. And that's just like the physical fitness and how to shoot a gun part
of it. How to shoot a gun. Make sure that you're okay running. Yeah. And it was, I actually had a lot of fun in basic training. And people are really shocked when I said that. But it's a mental game, the whole thing. And once you realize that, everything is okay. It really is. Like, they can't touch you. They can't, they can scream at your face, but so what? You just got to take it.
But you have to wake up ass early.
You do.
Do push-ups every day. But also, you're freakishly strong. I think this is something that we should reveal here on the podcast. You've helped a little bit with moving, and I've hung out with you when friends were moving and picking up furniture, and you were like blew my mind. You're strong like three bears.
I think it's because I'm so short and small and very compact.
Yeah. I was like, whoa. So maybe you pick that up in the military.
Maybe.
So you go through 6.5 weeks of basic, mm-hmm. and then you do all of this more vocational training,
yeah.
and that's maybe a few more months.
So then I was in Texas, in Wichita Falls, from September to about January, and then that's when I went to Virginia.
And meanwhile, your parents are back in New England, and are you able to, you're doing all this work, mm-hmm. obviously guided with one singular focus. I mean, yes, I want career training, I'm going to get ahead in the mm-hmm. world and blah, 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 but also, I need to help my dad, I need to help my family. Yeah. How soon into the process were you able to make him a dependent, put him on your health insurance?
It was about a year.
Oh, wow. So it took a while.
So it took a while because I didn't know that was an option.
Yeah.
It wasn't until, because my idea was I'm going in to make money and
send it back. Yeah.
And then I had wonderful supervisors. I had just really helping me trying to figure out what is the best course of action. How can I be helped? How can we make this work? And that was one of the things that we found out. And then once I found that out, I got letters. Everybody was helping me trying to make this happen. And then once he moved in with me, they really helped me with my schedule. So I would work, I requested to work the night shift. So during the day I could be there with him.
Gotcha. So at this point, was he in hospice? Did he have a home health care worker?
Yeah, it was hospice care.
Yeah, so you really needed to spend as much time with him while he was awake as you could.
Yeah, exactly.
And what about your mom? Was she able to come also?
Yeah, she came down after a while, and it was really tough on her. It was very, very tough. I became the matriarch of the family because just everything was very difficult for her.
I can't imagine. I mean, I've talked about this a little bit, I want to say 2 weeks ago on the show when I had my friend Varshana on, because she's a new doctor,
mm-hmm.
and we were thinking about the kinds of thing, and the first time she watched somebody die, and the first time that she, that somebody coded, and she was there, and it was very difficult. And I recently finished this book, Being Mortal, by Atul Gawande, which I've recommended on the show a couple of times, which is basically about how we manage end-of-life decisions and how we manage how we measure what somebody's wants and needs and pleasures are against extending life, and when is life extension actually damaging to somebody's psychology, and all of these very complicated decisions. And of course, the book is written in such a way that is very warm, and it makes you think a lot about these things. And I have a very, very dear friend who recently lost her younger sister, actually, which was really tough, to terminal cancer. And these things have been on my mind a lot lately, but I've never personally, it's like my grandparents died.
Right.
But grandparents die. They're supposed to. And your parents are also supposed to die, but they're supposed to die when you're older.
Mm.
And so what a difficult situation to be in when you're so young, and when you not only are having to cope with the emotional fallout of this, but also feeling basically ultimately responsible for making sure that everybody's okay.
Right. I think that helped me in the way, not helped, because I think it delayed the grieving process for me.
Hmm.
I couldn't grieve because my mother needed me.
Yeah.
I had to be there for her. I had to be making the decisions because she couldn't handle making those decisions. So it took a while for me to actually process. I remember at work after he passed away, people were surprised by how well I was when I came back to work. I was just socializing. It was fine. And people would, are you sure you're okay? It just because it hadn't really.
Yeah, because you were like still in denial.
Still in denial about it for a long time. I felt like I was definitely.
And did it take, you know, your mother moving back and away from you again and kind of getting back into your life?
She didn't move back. She couldn't.
Oh, she stayed with you.
She stayed with me. She went through a really rough, depressive state. She couldn't work. And it was really, really rough.
I can only imagine. I mean, I think that it's insane to me that the way that we structure, kind of legally structure corporate things in mm-hmm. this country, you know, bereavement, you can have like maybe a few days right. or like a week for, it's like, really? You know?
It's not enough.
No, it's the same way that maternity is too short, paternity is too short, yeah. bereavement is way too short. And yeah. I think I took a bereavement day when my grandpa died. You know what right, I mean? But right. I can only imagine if it was somebody in my nuclear family, especially if, as a younger person, or of course the person that you love.
Right.
Which is difficult, which people listening to the show have had to deal with. And I'm sure that they could definitely add to this conversation. So you're here, you're basically at this point when you've lost your father a year.
So I was 19 by this point. Okay. So I just turned.
So you're 2 years in the military, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. 2 years in putting a lot of effort into making sure that he's as comfortable as possible and that all the medication's paid mm-hmm. for. Did you go into debt during that time?
I did not. The military really, really helped. Once your dependent passes away, they pay for transportation costs. So that was paid for. There was part of funeral costs they don't cover for, but my military family really pulled together and really helped. It was an incredible experience.
That's so great. And so did you only do the mm-hmm. four required years? Are you, what do they call it? Reserves now?
So after, once you sign your contract, you do 4 years active and then 4 years inactive, which means that if war breaks out, they can call you back.
But you're not a reservist in the traditional sense where you go once a weekend.
No.
Sorry, 1 weekend a month.
Yeah, no, I didn't do that. I just did my 4 years and then.
And are you still now in that? No,
no,
you're not.
I'm done.
You're my age. Yeah. I can't do math. So you were 4 years inactive, but nothing.
Nothing, yeah.
Nothing happened.
I had to go one time. They ask you to come to the local base just to make sure you're still alive and you're still fit for training. If
Make sure you haven't gained 300 pounds. Exactly. Yeah. And you're off time.
That's right.
And so during that time, you know, you lost your father. You developed these new skills. You, even after you lost your father, you took care of your mother for another, sounds like
several
at least 2 years.
Yeah, several even years. After I got out, when we moved back to New Jersey, she couldn't work really full time. So that was my time when I had four jobs.
Oh, jeez.
I was bartending. I was taking pictures. I'm mostly bartending at several different places. I was taking pictures for bars at events. So I did that for a while.
And you were now not completely ex-military, but basically ex-military.
Mm-hmm, yep.
And the thought of school, of education, was it always in your mind?
Yeah, I wanted to get back to it. And I did. I was taking classes, local community colleges.
So kind of part-time working and part-time going to school.
Yep, never full-time school. And the idea of becoming a scientist went away for a while because for 4 years I hadn't taken a math class or I wanted to be an astronomer. That's what I wanted to do. I hadn't taken any hard math classes or hard science classes. And I was really terrified of getting back into it. Did I lose it all? Is this going to be hard for me?
Yeah.
So I think I definitely delayed it. So I took classes in other fields.
Classes that you knew you could handle.
I could handle.
While
I'd
still working for
you. Right. And because I'd always been a good student. And the idea of not doing well, not performing well was sort of terrifying to me.
And I can only imagine that you had like no social life.
No. Yeah. Well, I think again my work became my friends were, you know, the other bartenders I worked with. But really we would just socialize during work because then during the day I had to go to my other jobs and
But you had two severe times in your life when you were much younger than most people are when they experience this, where you basically left everything behind and started a new life in a new place where you didn't know anyone.
Mm-hmm.
When you first went to Langley, of course, I feel like basic training. Oh, when you went to Wichita Falls, too.
Right.
Basic training,
We're all in that together.
You're all in it. You're fucking busy, right? Like you're, not that you're not busy later, but like I'm sure you're falling asleep exhausted at the end of the night every night. But then when you went to Langley, and then when you went back home, mm-hmm. at least maybe you had some social ties when you went back home, which were helpful.
But it was different.
Yeah.
People had their
people
lives.
Leave.
Yeah, people leave. They're
at this point, people
families.
Had graduated
yeah.
college
exactly.
already.
They'd already gone somewhere else. So yeah. a lot of people weren't around.
And were you feeling behind?
Yeah. I still do. But I felt unaccomplished.
That really?
Was, that
For,
was the
even though you had accomplished so much.
To me, I felt, oh, I came back home and you know I don't have a degree under my belt. Here I am just bartending. What have I been doing with my life? I felt very, very unaccomplished. And
isn't it funny how that seems to be a cultural... I don't know, like there's a cultural story. And I think if you look back 50, 100 years, the cultural story for women was very different. Mm. You know, if you get a man very early, then you can leave home, you can go off with your man and blah, blah, and you don't want to be like the spinster that's left behind. Now the cultural story is very much surrounded by higher education. Mm-hmm. You know, as soon as you graduate high school, you go to college. Once you finish college, then you either start in a professional career or you get married and blah 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 mm-hmm. or you do both, which is more often the case, and so following just a slightly different track, you know, going into the military is like really fucking hard. It's like probably way harder than undergrad. And so but somehow you felt behind.
Yeah, I did, and that was rough. It was rough that I felt, talking to my other my friends, and people didn't, like, just to be clear, people didn't make me feel this way.
Sure.
I was feeling this way.
There's but I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of you feeling that way came from the fact that there's the norm,
right?
And you deviated from the norm.
Yeah.
And you didn't, in your mind, you didn't deviate in a way that was accomplished. You deviated in a way that was put you behind.
Behind, right, right.
Because, again, if you haven't graduated college by the time you're 22, you're behind, which is insane.
It is insane. Now, looking back, it's crazy that I thought that.
Yeah, but, I mean, how could you not? That's right. What we're told from
exactly.
the time we're young.
That's the rhetoric we're...
Yeah.
It's instilled in our brains. Yeah.
It really is. And for people who never went to college, I think that they struggle with that a lot. Well, I never finished or I never
right.
graduated from college. I know that's what I was, quote, supposed to do. Mm-hmm. I see it with people. I dropped out of my PhD program. I've met a few other people along mm-hmm. the way in SciComm who never finished certain degrees. And mm-hmm. there is always in the back of your head this like, well, one day I will, because if I don't, I haven't fully accomplished what I was supposed to accomplish. You know, like you just feel unfinished.
That's a shame. It's a shame that you feel like that, because that people do feel like that, because mm-hmm. you are still accomplishing so much. And then.
But you're right. I mean, it's just kind of like this. This story we're told of set a goal, achieve it, set a goal, achieve it, mm-hmm. set a goal, achieve it. And like, we're not often told in life by our mentors or by our role models that one of the best things you can do in life is like follow paths that you didn't know would be open to you. And if mm-hmm. it means that you never finish on a goal that you set earlier, like, this is better.
Yeah.
Like, fuck it. This was a cooler thing you got to do. Because how different would your life be if you hadn't gone into the military?
Super different. Yeah, I think it would have been different. But remember how I said I ended up exactly where
yeah.
I thought? Just delayed, just more circuitous? Is that
yeah,
a word?
That's a word, I think. I never know, by
I'm
the way.
I'm ESL, so that's usually the excuse that I say. Even though I've been living here since I was 11, when I say something wrong, I'm like, I'm ESL, guys, sorry.
I was going to ask, 11, and you don't have a hint of an accent.
Oh, yeah. So I blame this on kids being super mean to me when I first moved here. Because when I moved here, I did not speak a word of English. I couldn't even ask how to go to the bathroom.
Oh, wow.
Like, it was really, really bad. And I would go home every night and tell myself, Raquel, you're going to learn English so well that nobody's ever going to know you're not from this country.
And then you just really focused.
And then I did, yeah.
And did your folks learn English?
My dad, not really. Mm-hmm. My mom, she does speak a little bit. She has a very thick, very thick accent.
Is it one of those things where, and by the way, so far, if you've noticed, we haven't mentioned where you're from. I don't think we've said it. So I'm going to take a second before you say uh-huh. it, because I want everybody to guess in their heads based on how you talk. They're going to have no idea. They're going to have to guess based on like your name, which even then, I'm not sure that would
yeah.
tell me. So anyway, are you one of these, do you have that relationship where you speak Portuguese? No, where your mom speaks Portuguese to you and you speak English back
no,
to her?
No, I speak Portuguese back to her.
Oh, you do.
Her.
So you just go back and forth Portuguese. Yeah. So, yeah, you're from Portugal.
So, I'm from Portugal. And that's why I really think that's why I don't have an accent, because I really focused on getting. But now I'm like, I wish I had an accent. Accents are amazing.
If I were to peg your accent, though, then the question is, what dialect here did you pick up? You know what I
interesting,
mean?
Interesting, yeah.
Is it more like a Northeast, or is it, when did you move to California?
Back in 2009, I think it was.
Okay, so, so you've been here as long as I've had my laptop.
Oh.
My sad,
your workhorse.
Exactly. So, wow, it's already 2015. So you've been here 6 years, but that's not long enough to like talk like a surfer.
Right. No. I definitely noticed that I pick up. When I was in Texas, I had a Texas
legit
accent.
I love it.
And then I remember going to New Jersey for Christmas one year, and I was at the movies and I was paying, and I don't know, I don't remember what I said, but it was really, really Southern. And the guy was like, where are you from? I'm like, New Jersey here. And he's like, no, no way.
That's awesome. And you were in Wichita Falls, which is like,
really?
Yeah, that's like real Southern. Yeah. I'm sure we have some listeners from there. I definitely know I have a lot of Texas listeners. I was actually on a shoot the other day and the PA was like, hey, where are you from? I was wearing long sleeves so you couldn't see my Texas tattoo. And he was like, where are you from? And I was like, Texas. And he was like, are you serious? And I was like, yeah. He was like, I'm from Vancouver. And I could have sworn you had a Canadian accent.
Oh, no
way. And people
way.
Say that to me all the fucking time.
Really? Do you have a lot of Canadian friends that
I don't
you pick
know.
Up?
I have no idea why. I think it's only because I say about like that. And okay. I have no idea why. I think it's because I watched a lot of Degrassi when I was growing up. Don't judge me. So, getting back to the story of Raquel's life, you do all of this hard work, and then you find yourself kind of back where you were before this crazy life sort of roller coaster happened. You're back home, but you're also in a hard place because your mother is still struggling. You've lost your father. You made money, but you spent it on medical expenses, and now you're struggling to kind of now at, what, 22 or 21, make some of the decisions that a lot of kids are making at 18.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And what made you decide, at a certain point, I can't keep doing this part-time, I have to throw myself back into my education?
I decided that I wasn't going to let fear dictate my choices, and the reason why I hadn't taken any math or science class is because I was afraid of failure. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to be that person. I didn't want that for myself. So I started taking classes at the local community college and physics and math classes. And I turned out to do really well. And the professors, I've been to a lot of community colleges, and the professors at community college, they care so much. They really want you to succeed in life, and so I'm super, super lucky that I got that experience there. So they really motivated me. Hey, you're doing well. You can do this. And one thing led to another, and I just kept taking higher and higher. But it's community college, so it's only the first 2 years of classes,
so
that you can take.
Freshman and sophomore.
Yeah.
Undergrad.
So,
yeah.
So it got to a point where there were no more physics classes. There were no more math classes that I could take. And I decided, okay, well, this is the next step. I can move on to an actual four-year college in the science. And I got this idea. I wanted to get away. I wanted to get away from New Jersey, from home, because, again, I felt like here I am back in the place where I started, and I'm feeling unaccomplished. I need to try this somewhere else. And I hate the cold. I'm not a cold person. I hate snow.
You're Portuguese.
I'm Portuguese. Yeah. I'm not meant for that. I'm not bred for that. And so I got the idea. I wanted to go to California. And I was dating somebody at the time who also wanted to get away. And he had a job. He's a consultant. So it didn't matter for him where he lived. And we decided, well, let's just go to California. And I was reading a lot about California colleges, the UC system, and how they take preference for students who are transferring from a community college in California.
Yeah, it's actually really hard to get into a California school if you don't live in California.
Exactly, yeah. So,
and you'll notice when you apply online because they ask you like 30 different ways where in California you're from.
Yes. Like, are you from California? Are you sure? How long have you lived here?
Yeah. Are you from LA or San Diego? Yeah. Maybe San Francisco. You're like, no, I don't. But I still want to go here. I did not get into the school.
Because you weren't from here.
Damn it.
Yeah, so I did a lot of research and I said, okay, well, the best way that I can get into the UC system is if I go to community college first. And so that's what I did. I moved to LA.
So smart.
And I attended Los Angeles City College for a year. And then I applied and I transferred to UCLA. And that's actually where I ended up doing my undergrad.
And how much of the work? So at this point, you've basically maxed out. You've taken 2 years worth around there of at least science and math, but some other classes at community colleges on the East Coast. Then you've come to LA and taken another year. So you probably had to retake some classes.
Yeah. And I just added other classes. So when you transfer to the UC system, they want you to take not just your core classes for your major. They want you to take English and writing. And
yeah. So you actually had holes in your schedule that you needed to fill anyway.
Exactly.
So then when you came in as a junior, were you were actually a junior? You didn't have to do a bunch of like redos?
No, I was a junior. I actually had way more credits than I needed.
That's good. Because I know sometimes that's a struggle and a concern for people who are ready to take that step is, am I going to have to redo all of the work that I did? But I think for the most part, undergraduate institutions, or at least I'd hope to think, and I think that they're getting smarter about this, have an understanding that individuals who went to community college and who did really well in community college have come at their education in, from a non-traditional way. Mm-hmm. Either they're a mom or a dad and they're trying to care for their children. They have a full-time job. They're caring for somebody else in their family. They had some sort of big life experience that made them come later. That's why I love state schools. Like when I, the whole time that I taught in Texas and New York, I was always either at, I was at the University of North Texas and I was at the City University of New York, like state and city colleges. And I just felt like the resolve of the kids, and I shouldn't say kids because half the people in the classes I taught were older than I was. They wanted to be there. Like, yeah, you still had the little shithead kids who were like at school because their parents made them and they were like on their phones the whole time during class, but you could just throw them out, which was awesome. But I did love that I didn't have to struggle with what some, I think, people have to struggle with in more, I don't know, exclusive universities where the people are there and they've busted their asses to be there because not because anything was made easy for them in life. It was like they're there against the odds, despite those odds. And I've always really appreciated that because I think it gave a resolve to the students that some people don't get to see.
Yeah, I definitely noticed that as well. My a community college students there were really motivated to do well, and they showed up to class every day. They were paying to be there, and so they it was a struggle for them to afford that. So it was, to them being there, it's just it just made sense. And I definitely noticed once I actually got into the 4-year college, students didn't show up to class, and that would just blow my mind. Like, you're paying to be here. How are you not here?
Yeah.
Blew my, like, they just didn't care.
It's such a weird thing. And so you were at UCLA, which also is interesting because in LA there are two really big universities. There's USC and UCLA, like in LA proper. And it always blows my mind because, like, and these are massive generalizations, so don't take me at my complete word. But generally speaking, USC is where a lot of rich kids go,
right?
But it's in like the ghetto,
right?
And then UCLA is where kids usually with lesser means, but also some rich kids will go there, but it's in a really rich neighborhood. And so it's an odd juxtaposition. It's like, how do you afford to live by UCLA? Because it's so, and then in USC, it's like, you're already so rich, but you can find an apartment that's like nothing,
nothing,
but it has bars on the windows and there's a liquor store next door. Slumming it at USC. It's
I know
ridiculous.
A lot of So for me, I ended up living in Hollywood.
Because it's way cheaper.
I could not afford living in Westwood.
That's a shit commute, too. I just made it the other day.
Oh, my God. It was 7.6 miles away. And on a Friday afternoon, going back home, it would take me an hour and a half.
I know. People are spitting out their coffee right now. That's what LA is like. It's crazy.
Awful.
Yeah. Less than 8 miles. And it takes about an hour. I just did a talk at the Nanotech Institute UCLA. Yeah, it was really fun. And on the way there, it was pretty good. It was like 30 minutes, but on the way back, it was at least 45.
What a shit show.
Just to get back to Hollywood.
Oh, LA traffic.
It's so, and also I was like bumbling around like an idiot trying to figure out how to park. Parking at university is such a pain in the ass.
It's awful.
Oh, so confusing.
Yeah. And I know students that needed to live nearby because they didn't have cars.
Oof.
In a one-bedroom apartment, there'd be like five of them.
Yeah. It's like
crazy.
Impossible to live here. The cost of living is obscene. Mm-hmm. I had that problem when I was in New York. I was in Queens, which made it a little cheaper. But I was teaching at Queens College. I was doing my graduate work at CUNY, which luckily I was able to do most of my classes on that Queens College campus, even though the Graduate Center is on Fifth Avenue, like in the city. You never go there except to turn in your paperwork. But I lived in Forest Hills, and my apartment actually in the grand scheme, I think back and I'm like, that was a good deal. But it wasn't a good deal. It was like half the size of this apartment cost the same amount.
Ugh.
And I took the bus and the subway every day. It was freezing cold. And it wasn't even like people had it so much worse than I did. But I remember making a budget and I was $600 short every month.
Oh, my gosh.
I was just like, okay. Like, you know, I was a PhD student. So my PhD was paid for.
Mm-hmm.
But between... And I got a stipend because I taught, but it didn't cover bills and rent.
Yeah.
It's just, it's hard. It graduate level education is hard. And at a certain point, I remember my father saying to me, like, it's okay to put things on your credit card. Like, I would never teach you this kind of fiscal responsibility otherwise. But there's a certain point in your life when you're like, I want to finish my education and I want to do it in a way that makes the most sense for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've got to figure out financially how to just get through this so that when I start making money, I can pay it back. But I know a lot of people are in a tough place with that right now because the jobs aren't there.
Aren't there, yeah.
In the sciences, it's I don't want to say it's completely different, but sci-tech is where the jobs actually are, which is great. The problem is, for a lot of people, you have to actually finish the degree.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I have a master's in neurobiology. You know what that's worth? Not a lot. And if it had been in psych, even less. Because you really can't do much until you have your PhD in a clinical field.
Mm-hmm.
But you did your undergrad in what, physics?
Or? Geophysics and space physics.
What? Did you say true physics?
Geophysics.
Geophysics.
And space physics.
And space physics. Was it a dual major?
It's just what it was called.
Okay, so that department is geo and space. So that's what, planetary science and astronomy, basically.
Yeah, so at UCLA, there's a physics and astronomy department, mm-hmm. and then there's a Department of Earth, Planetary, and Space Sciences. So my degree is from the Department of Earth, Planetary, and Space Sciences, but most of my classes were in the physics department. So we had to take all of the physics classes, but then your electives are in the Earth, Planetary, and Space Science department.
Because what you're specifically interested in is planetary bodies that are pretty near to Earth, right?
Yeah, just the solar system.
Okay.
All the planets in the solar system, how they formed, the surface processes on them. So my PhD now is actually in geology. Which is
kind of so weird.
It's super weird because I tell people that I'm a geologist and then they ask me about rocks. And yes, I'm learning about rocks, but I'm not a geologist yet. I don't consider myself a geologist. I love rocks and I'm fascinated by rocks. But
well, that's helpful.
Yeah.
Because if you weren't, that'd be tough.
Yes. So the UCLA doesn't have a planetary science degree. So you can do... I could have done geophysics and space physics PhD, but I've already taken a lot of those because those classes, a lot of them weren't offered. They're joint offered, graduate and undergraduate.
We have that at my school. It's 4,000, 5,000 level. And
yes.
Then if you're a grad student, you like teach one of the lectures. Yeah. Or you write a paper.
Yeah. So I took a lot of those classes already. And I'm like, well, I want to learn something new.
Yeah.
So
yeah. It would not be fun to can you imagine retaking a bunch of classes you already took? It's like same professor. So, hey guys, I'm back.
Yeah. Doing this all over again.
I guess I'll just study from my old exams.
I know I have them. I know what's going to be on there. I should have done that, right?
Right.
Oh, it's so much easier.
Done so quickly. No, that sounds atrocious. I would not have fun with that. But it's similar. It's funny because Crystal, Crystal Dilworth, who I've had on the show, mm-hmm. she graduated from Caltech, and same kind of thing. She's technically a chemist. She has mm-hmm. a degree in molecular chemistry. Mm. She's a neuroscientist.
Right.
Like, it's just you could at Caltech, they don't have like a biological neuroscience mm. degree.
Oh, it's their computational.
It's computational. Right. So the only way for her to do more biochemistry was to be in the chem department, which mm-hmm. is weird. But, you know, everybody does it. So mm-hmm. so you're in geology, but you're doing mostly planetary science.
Yeah. Yep.
And some people struggle with this. I learned early on, I was interested in doing paleontology. Mm-hmm. And I realized that most paleontologists have geology degrees. Yeah. And I do not like rocks.
Oh, you do?
Rocks are really confusing and kind of boring to me. And so I love fossils. And then I was like, you kind of have to know about rock to know about a fossil. I was like, maybe this isn't the best course for me. But yeah, it's funny. You think about the job you want to have. Uh-huh. Then you've got to think about what it means to get that job.
Yeah.
And what are some of the alternative pathways? Because there are people who study in fields that don't seem related. They're totally related. And mm-hmm. they learn all of the skills that they need. But like, who would have thunk? You know, let's say that you don't have a strong physics background and you're afraid you're not going to get into the physics department, but you could potentially get into the biology department. What are you interested in studying? Is it, you know, biophysics? Like, is there a way to have this joint kind of career?
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I don't know. There's always a way. Yeah.
Well, that's what I think the thing about the PhD, it's not about the subject. Yeah, you're learning. You're going to be a specialist in this one thing. Mm-hmm. But what I think you get out of a PhD is the skill set. So whatever skill set you want to acquire, that's what you should be pursuing. So
yeah, for sure. And like, really think about that. You know, if you're interested, especially if you're a younger listener and you're thinking you're in high school or you're in undergrad and you're trying to figure it out, one of the best ways to really know that is to find somebody who does what it is you think you want to do
mm-hmm.
and ask them for, you know, time. Ask them if they'll take a meeting with you. They always will, unless they're jerks, and then find another one. Find somebody who's not a jerk and sit down with them and ask them, like, really, what do you actually do? Like, I think I know what you do. Because I saw this all the time with paleontology.
Mm.
It was like, I want to dig up bones. Paleontologists don't really dig up bones. Like, they might do a little bit of field work throughout the year. Some do more than others, but right. like, usually the paleontologists aren't the ones sitting there digging.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, they do other stuff.
They're doing the thinking.
Exactly. So, this, you know, it's like, oh, well, I want to look at the sky and I want to understand, blah, blah, blah. Well, how do you want to look at the sky? And in what way do you want to do that? Because there are hugely different career mm-hmm. paths that you can take and different specialties. And granted, you don't have to know now. That's mm-hmm. the great thing, too.
Yeah.
Sometimes so when you go into that department, you're like, holy shit, that's a thing? There's a telescope that uses sound? You know, like there's like cool shit out there that you didn't know about, so that's exciting too.
Yeah. So for me, I'm doing a geology PhD, but I use telescopes.
Mm-hmm.
I go to Mauna Kea and use telescopes in Mauna Kea, and I work with spacecraft data. And I'm doing a geology PhD, and you wouldn't think that that's you could be doing that while doing your geology PhD, but that's what your degree is.
Yeah. Yeah. And Mauna Kea, is that in Hawaii?
Yeah, it's
yeah, that's
in
legit.
Hawaii. Yeah,
that's fun.
It's not bad.
How often
like
do you
it.
Get to go to Hawaii?
So I've actually only been once to actually observe because mm-hmm. They have a great thing, which is not so great for me. You can access the computers remotely. So the past three times that we've observed, it's been remotely. So just here in LA, in the office, just remotely controlling, talking to the telescope operator in Hawaii. Instead of actually going there.
And we sound like such jerks right now because you're like, just here in LA looking at the palm trees. It's pretty warm. It's like 85 degrees in November.
Oh,
and somebody,
terrible.
Meanwhile, back in Jersey is like, fuck you. I want to go.
Super lucky. I know, super lucky.
So that's cool that you get to use Mauna Kea data. And is that a light telescope?
This one is an infrared. I use the IRTF, which is the Infrared Telescope Facility. It's a NASA telescope. And it just looks in the infrared spectrum of light. And we were looking for water ice signatures on the moon. So that's one of the things that we do. So most of my research is based around water.
Oh, interesting.
Water ice.
And it's funny because you're making a face kind of like, I didn't intend that.
No.
It just sort of happened.
It just sort of happened because I just made that connection recently because one of the first research projects that I've worked on and I'm still working on is water on Mars. water ice on Mars. And now, wait, I'm also doing water ice on the moon. So there's this trend of water, water in the solar system.
So how exciting was it with NASA's most recent find?
Oh, this is super exciting. So with the water, the
like
water.
The bands.
Yeah. So my research is slightly related to that. So it was inspired by these streaks, the recurring slope linea, the terrible name. Do you know how that name came about?
Slope linea?
Recurring slope linea, RSLs. That's what they're called. Recurring. So it's these dark features that appear in the warm seasons of Mars, and then they fade and retreat during the cold seasons. But they didn't want to associate it with water. But that was their first instinct.
Yeah.
Like the people who discovered this, it's water. So they wanted to give it as plain of a name as they could. So it's this awful name. I hate it. RSLs. It doesn't tell you anything of what they are.
So
but yeah.
Does that mean that like people, most researchers who have been looking at these phenomena kind of always thought and sort of hoped in the back of their heads, this is water, but because there wasn't enough evidence to support it, it was like, let's be conservative.
Because it's a big deal.
Yeah, that's, it's a huge deal.
It's a big deal.
Yeah.
Like for water means life.
You want to be sure.
You want to be sure. And that's the thing we're looking for. That's probably one of the most important questions, I think, in planetary science is there life elsewhere in the solar system? And water is associated with that. If you find water, there's usually life. So saying that these things are being formed by water have such implications that I think people are really, really careful about saying that that's what caused them.
And so to be able to say like that there's, you know, a pretty high level of confidence that this is associated with water is really exciting.
Super exciting.
And it undid some of the science in The Martian because you don't need to make your own water to grow them damn potatoes.
You can just. Yeah, there's so
in
much
the soil.
There.
I know.
So much there.
Like we didn't know it. So what about Europa? Does Europa excite you?
Oh, Europa is super exciting. Oh, the gigantic ocean underneath the kilometers thick of ice.
It's very cool.
Yeah.
And that, you know, there's a mission in the works.
That's right.
We'll see. We'll see what happens with that. But
water turns out to be everywhere. Do you know that there's water on Mercury? Water ice?
That's
on
crazy.
Mercury.
On Mercury.
Which is the closest
it's hot.
Planet. Yes.
It's little and red and hot.
And there's water ice deposits in these poles,
in
these craters at the poles.
That's crazy.
It's amazing.
The poles confuse me. I want to talk to somebody about that sometime, but I want to learn more so I don't sound as much like an idiot. I have a book on my shelf called North Pole, South Pole that I haven't read yet, but it's all about the poles and magnets because magnets are like magic.
They really are.
They're very confusing.
I'm pretty sure that's how they work.
It's one of those really simple concepts in science that's not as simple as it seems. You know what I mean? Like the fact that magnetic fields exist and why do they exist and how do they exist and how can you create them with electricity? And I don't know. It's fun. It's fun and it's confusing.
I'm excited for that book. You have to tell me all about it.
I'm like, you can borrow it if you want to. It's been on my shelf for like 2 years.
You got to get to it.
Not been prioritized. Do you have a chance to read books ever?
I do.
It's so hard.
But you try to.
Oh, good. What did you read recently?
Seven Eves. Seven Eves.
What is it?
I don't remember the author.
That's okay.
Terrible.
I'll look it up. But I don't get it. Seven Eves.
Seven
like two
Eves.
Words? Like
E-A-V-E-S. It's one word.
Oh, okay.
Seven Eves. And
I see
it's it. It's about, who is the writer?
It's a novel by
Nicholson, is it?
Neal Stephenson.
Neal Stephenson.
Yep.
Fascinating book. It spans, the timeline of the book spans over 5,000 years, and it's about what would happen. This, I'm not giving anything away because it happens first page in the book. The moon explodes, just disintegrates, and humanity has now to survive. Like, and it's
and we don't think about that because we're like, we don't need the moon. No, we need the moon, don't we?
We need the moon. We need the moon. And there's all these effects, things that happen afterwards, and humanity has to now survive.
Oh, cool. So it's a science-based fiction.
Yes. And it was really good. I really liked the science in it.
That's exciting.
And there's biology, and there's ethics, all these things. You know, you have to, human race has to continue, but you have limited amount of people, so what are you going to do? And so it's really, really fascinating book. I really,
that's
really
awesome.
Liked it.
Is it a page-turner?
It took me a while to get into it, but it was recommended to me, and I'm like, and I respected this person's opinion, so I figured, you know, just give it another try, just keep good going. So I think the beginning was kind of tough for me, but then once the action started happening, like, whoa, okay, let's go. This is amazing. And then after that, every page was like, I want to know what's happening next.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know, that's how I felt about or feel about The Wire. It's my favorite TV series ever. For a lot of people have the same experience where they're like, I can't really get into it. Like the first, second episode, it's like, no, I know there's too many characters and you're really confused and you're not invested, but like, just keep going. And then once you go through, you're like,
I had that. I needed to watch it twice.
Yeah.
And then I was hooked. Yeah.
So good. Oh my God, I love The Wire. So did you love The Martian too?
I didn't read it.
Okay.
But I saw the movie and I thought it was great.
Yeah.
Great movie.
I still recommend reading it, even though the movie is very true to the film. There's just so much more. It's kind of like the film plus
more.
Three other movies.
Nice.
You know, there's just so much more in the book because they couldn't pack it all in to the film. But they did a pretty good job of being very close to the book, which made me happy. There's a lot more of the word fuck in the book. He says fuck like 100 times in the book. They couldn't do that in the movie because it had PG-13 rating. What a shame.
What a shame.
So what is your actual like research or have you identified your research question yet? Or you're still trying to, you're like, I like the moon. I like Mars. Mm-hmm. I like water. I'm trying to figure it all out.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty much where I'm at.
Cool. That's what a fun place to be.
Yeah. Although it's kind of hard for me to narrow down. I have so many different interests. Mm-hmm. So it's been hard for me to focus on one project because they're all so exciting.
Yeah.
So I'm in that phase where I'm talking to my advisor a lot and developing an actual thesis and what can I work on, and I should be writing. You know, that's
Whatever. I should Everybody be writing writes a at paper. The very end. It, no, it's.
There's just it's always just hovering over me like you should be writing.
Collect your data first. It's fine. You got time. So you do have an advisor. You're in a lab. So your lab has general research focuses. So you can kind of use that to guide yourself a little bit.
So we mostly do it's spacecraft. We build instruments that go on spacecraft
to
other planets. So
cool.
Yeah.
What kind of instruments?
So we have one that is on board LRO, which is the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and it's an infrared camera.
Nice.
And it's looking at the temperature variation across the moon, and it's been in orbit. I think it's been 6 years now, and it's revolutionized the way we look at the moon. So one of the most interesting findings about specifically from this instrument is that some of the coldest places in the solar system turn out to be inside these craters the moon.
Because they're so deep?
So deep and so dark. Because the way that the moon, you know how the Earth has a slight tilt in its orbit? Well, the moon is almost perfectly straight. And so sunlight doesn't get into some of these places in these craters on the poles.
How funny.
So for billions of years, these craters have not seen any sunlight. No sunlight has reached the inside of them. So it's roughly the temperature of space, which is like
cold.
Around five degrees Kelvin.
Yeah.
Almost 5 degrees above absolute zero. It's really, really, really cold. And so that's one of the things that we
that's
work
crazy,
on.
That's crazy. Yeah. Because it's so close to us.
Yeah.
And also, I think we often think of heat as being a function of proximity to something that's hot, but we don't think of heat as being directly related to light.
Right. Well, in the solar system, the temperature of something is highly correlated with how much sunlight it's getting.
That's really funny. And we know that, again, going to be annoying and talk about LA in November when it's like, guys, literally it was 85 degrees today. It was horrible. I feel really guilty. I was wearing flip-flops. It was crazy. And it's late in the year. But when it gets to be nighttime, it's freezing outside in LA. And by freezing, I mean like 55 because I'm a wimp.
That's freezing. That's icicles falling out of my nose. Yes.
Yeah, it's definitely, but you can't, and that's something that people don't realize when they come visit LA is that even in the summer, even when it's really hot, you need a jacket at night. It gets cold because it's almost desert, you know what I mean? And we have that issue. Whereas in Texas, where I grew up, and I don't know if it's the same in Portugal where you grew up, you would wear a tank top during the day in the summer and you'd still be hot at night. It was like there was just a warmth that hung in the air. Mm-hmm. But I guess LA is like a little microcosm of the moon.
There you go. so that's one of the instruments that we're working on. And then the other one that it just got selected to go on the Mars 2020 rover.
Oh, fun.
It's a ground penetrating radar. So it's going to use radar to image the subsurface of Mars.
Oh, cool. So it can see what's below the soil.
What's below the soil.
Oh,
and that's
nice.
Interesting because we know that there's subsurface ice
yeah.
And we want to see, maybe we can see some of those layers, not just ice, but also other deposits, other sediments that have been deposited, perhaps from water, from rivers or lakes.
Is there a chance, and tell me if I'm crazy in asking this, is there a chance that below the surface, somewhere on the planet, based on its tilt and its orbit and everything, that there would ever be a reservoir or a river of running water? Is that, or does that just seem really far-fetched?
So that's one of the ideas of, so these, again, going back to these RSLs, mm-hmm. they're occurring slow planea, these features.
Oh, then. Yeah, so they're obviously moving.
So they're moving, so there's got, the water's coming from somewhere. Now, the big question is where is that water coming from? We don't know.
And is it liquid as it's moving, or is it kind of ice forming and then retracting and
We don't know. But one of the ideas is maybe there's subsurface water, a mm-hmm. reservoir somewhere where it's warm enough. It's insulated from the cold. And so as the sun heats the surface, it propagates down and it keeps it insulated. And mm-hmm. But then
there's like dormant volcanoes and shit, right? So there might be areas where there's,
we don't know.
Yeah, something liquid from the core that's warming a region, or I don't know.
Yeah, it could be. That's the exciting thing. We don't know.
And so this kind of a tool, this kind of a radar that penetrates the surface could potentially tell you, answer some of those questions.
It could, but it's, radar is kind of difficult to, the data is difficult to interpret.
Oh, gotcha.
Because it's just imaging. We don't know.
Yeah, it's not chemical.
It's not chemical. We don't know where we're looking at. And, for example, briny surface, so salty water can mm-hmm. look very different than liquid water. So, and it's hard to get that data. So, again, it's an imaging thing.
But at least if you have an image of something that looks interesting, then later the next rover that has a drill bit or something, you could send it to the right place. You could dig.
But so NASA has all these limitations of where you can send rovers to.
True, because there's a treaty.
Yes.
There's a treaty about not contaminating other worlds.
So if you think that there's going to be liquid water,
you cannot
go there.
Shit. We talked about this on the Skeptics Guide, that by definition, finding a place that is kind of ripe for investigating, you can't investigate.
You can't investigate. Yeah.
It's so sad.
It is
so
sad.
So it's only if we stumble upon it accidentally.
Right,
and then we have to pull out as fast as we can, because the idea is that we don't want, you know, we do a good job, right, of decontaminating these rovers, but they're not perfect. And mm-hmm. we don't want to send alien, meaning from us,
right.
bacteria or life mm-hmm. to a region and then start populating it on Mars.
Yeah.
Although we probably already did.
Because we actually don't completely sterilize.
Yeah.
It costs too much money.
Yeah. And we've made big mistakes. Like, I think on this last rover, there was a big story about, like, certain things were sterilized. Like, the bolts were sterilized, but we used an unsterilized, like, bit.
Right.
You know? So it was like, ah, fuck. Like, and it's one of those things that has, you know, it's not additive. It's like one mistake. It contaminates the whole thing.
The whole planet.
Like, oh, shit.
And you look at it like, oh, I know that bacteria. That's just like here on Earth.
And there's also a good chance that, like, especially with the moon, mm-hmm. but maybe with Mars, that certain astronomical events could have actually flung bacteria far enough. Mm. You know, I've heard a lot of those interesting theories about, like, the impact that potentially killed the dinosaurs could have flung all sorts of Earth bacteria into the cosmos. And yeah, there have been studies that show that, like, shit can live up there.
Yep.
In, like, a vacuum.
Life is really hardy.
Yeah, it is,
life
right?
Life finds a way. It's kind of incredible. Which, to me, it's mind-boggling why we haven't found life somewhere else. Because everywhere we find, here on Earth, if there's a place, there's probably life living there. Anything lives here, everywhere here on Earth. Why not in other places as well? So
yeah, it just makes you think that the reason we haven't found it yet is because we aren't sophisticated enough.
Right.
Like, we don't have the right tools
exactly.
yet.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like, once we know exactly how to look for it, we'll be like, oh, shit, it's everywhere.
Of course it is.
Yeah. But we're so blind to that. And it's so funny to me how many people have that perspective of, like, we are the only ones.
No, we are not special.
It's so funny, too, because I feel like I had a mix-up with that when I was young and I was growing up in Texas in the Bible Belt.
Right.
And there was this idea of, I was trying to be a good, solid skeptic, right, as I was getting older. And so UFOs I knew didn't sit right. Like, we've never been visited. So in debunking the idea of UFOs, I think I threw the baby out with the bathwater and debunked the idea of life existing, you know, that, like, only crazy people think that. And so it definitely took probably being a science communicator and doing a lot of my own research and starting to write in physics and astronomy, which is not my background, to learn, oh, no. Like, the predominant view is that there is life, a lot of it, and that it's, you know, even though it's highly unlikely, when you calculate those, you know, how big the universe is, it's actually highly likely.
Right.
Which sounds weird, but it's true. And so, yeah, I wonder if other people have that experience of being overly skeptical or kind of mixing up two things in their mind and saying, well, I'm skeptical against this, therefore I'm going to say X is not true too.
It's valid, though. I think it's a very valid opinion to have if you don't really think about all the details.
Yeah,
makes sense.
It's like the way that we develop, I think, critical thinking skills is that we have to find that sweet. You know, we always say that the best scientists, the two tools that you need as a scientist are to be simultaneously open-minded and skeptical, which sound like opposing things to be.
But you have to.
You do. And yeah. I think that it takes, especially with when you're growing up and you're having life experiences and you're reading and you're learning more, you kind of err on one side too much and then on the other, and then eventually you try and find that balance. Mm-hmm. It's not easy.
Mm-mm.
You know, I find myself being overly skeptical a lot. And, you know, it's kind of my job. I'm a skeptic and I even work on the skeptic's guide. But I do find myself being like, that's bullshit. And then somebody's like, no, but like legit, there's 10 studies supporting it.
I'm but
like,
you're open-minded about it. Yeah. You know, your initial reaction might be, yeah, no, that's bullshit. But then I'm sure if
you're given the research, and you're like, okay.
I think that's better than being the other way around.
Probably. Yeah. What do you say? You want to be open-minded, but not so much that your brains fall out? Not good. See, she's never heard that before.
I had not.
Because she's Portuguese. Are there any fun phrases in Portuguese that don't really translate, or like cool words? Oh, you have a tattoo.
Yeah, it's in Latin though.
Oh, fuck.
I know. Oh. It's not Portuguese.
I thought it was.
There's a word.
Yes.
It
was the girl at the restaurant.
Yes.
So we went out to lunch once and the waitress had a word tattooed on her hand that was a Portuguese word. And you said there's no English translation.
Mm-hmm. So the word is saudade and there is no translation for it. But it implies it's this melancholy, this longing for your people and your land. And I don't think that there's a word.
Yeah, it's like homesickness, but more broad.
Yes.
It's homesickness for like bigger picture home, not like for my physical house.
Yeah, no. It's your country and your people, the food and the culture. And I think it comes because we're a seafaring nation and we've always had the explorers and people would go off and maybe never come back. And so that was the word. They missed home. They missed their family. They missed their land and their foods.
That's beautiful. Also, when you think about America, you know, we really are a nation of immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
There's only one core of natives, and those natives actually don't fully or even remotely represent what we think of as modern American culture. They, because of our horrific colonial treatment of them, they actually didn't lay the foundation for what we think of as American culture. American culture is by and large just appropriated from other places. It's English culture, it's French culture, it's German culture. And so because of that, we don't have a food. You know what I mean? We don't have there are music things that came out of here. And yes, I have it too when I go and I travel overseas for long periods of time. I want to come home. Mm-hmm. Everybody does. They're excited until they're not anymore and then they want to come home. So I do get homesick, but there's definitely not like, who are my people? Like my people are from everywhere.
Right.
You know what I mean? And there are up until a more modern time, you could go to these countries like France or Portugal, and even to some extent today, and there's a Frenchness or a Portugueseness to them that I don't think we have.
I don't
think what's
so
American
either.
Food? Like burgers and hot dogs? We didn't even invent either of those things, did we?
I don't know.
Pizza?
Is that, what would that be?
I don't know. Italian? People always say it's Italian. I don't think it's actually.
You're Italian, right?
I'm barely Italian. I know nothing about my Italian heritage. But Puerto Rican, which is funny because it's a Commonwealth of the United States, that I get.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's a Puerto Rican culture. Yeah. There's a people.
Very strong,
there's a music.
Too.
It's very strong. It's very nationalistic. Although, just because it's not its own country, it doesn't matter because there's a flag and there's a dish. And like my mom's arroz con pollo is like so yummy and delicious. And it's very Puerto Rican because arroz con pollo from other Latin countries are super different.
Yeah.
And that's because we were more in Puerto Rico, we were more Spanish, or it's just a very interesting mix of like native and Spanish culture.
Yeah. And you definitely don't have that here in the US.
Oh God, no. Nope. It's like, I don't crave hamburgers. When I, and also when you travel overseas, there's like American versions of everything everywhere you go. You go to tourist traps everywhere and it's like, you can get a burger here? Like, are you kidding me?
They're catering to you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's sad. I need to leave this country again.
Yeah, where do you want to go?
I don't know. I went to Paris last. Hmm. I think I want to go to South America. I haven't spent enough. I've only been to Ecuador. I've been to the Galapagos, but I've never really spent time in South America. I've been to Mexico and Central America, but that's when I lived in Texas.
Right, right. Yeah.
Have you spent a lot of time?
Not in South America.
In the lower hemisphere?
Nope. No, really? I haven't. No,
yeah,
I
feel like that's a place. It's funny because it's so close to us, but we don't travel there enough here in the States. I know a certain percentage of the listenership is outside of the States, but it's interesting. It's so heavily linked to the language, obviously. Like the majority of listeners of the podcast are American. And then I can actually pull up the stats because they blow my mind. And I'm so excited by them when I read them. But it's mostly American. And then, of course, England.
Right.
And then I think Australian after that.
Nice.
But then they start to get really interesting. Let's see stats. Let's look at overalls. Not last 7 days. Let's look at overall top countries. Oh, sorry, Canada. So US, then Canada, then United Kingdom, then Australia, right? That makes sense.
Yeah.
And then let's see, Sweden, Germany, Norway, New Zealand, Netherlands, Finland, Ireland, Brazil.
Wow.
Denmark, Mexico, Japan, Poland. And then what, Spain, South Africa, France is below South Africa. That is surprising. Switzerland, Philippines, Thailand. And then as you go down, it gets really, it's like, you know, Singapore, Israel, Romania, Croatia, like Saudi Arabia. I have
any
a huge
Portuguese?
Listenership.
What about Portuguese?
Let me see. Portugal. Oh, there you are. Portugal, you are number 23 on the
list. Okay, not bad.
Yeah. But like, you know, Korea is 36.
Wow.
Serbia is 43. I think it's so cool. And I'm always surprised by how high the listenership is from Saudi Arabia. I'm like, that's awesome, you guys. And like from African nations, like,
yeah.
Any
Angola?
That's
actually where my mom is from.
Oh, really? They're not in the top 50.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Angola's not in the top 50. Dominican Republic is number 50. That's fun, though. Isn't it cool how you can just, like, talk on a microphone?
Amazing.
And, like, put it on iTunes.
And people everywhere want to listen to you? That's incredible.
I don't know. That's strong. But they can. They have the opportunity. And I think that's really cool. Do you know that we've been talking now for an hour and 10 minutes?
No way. That's amazing.
I know. We've flown through. But I feel like we covered the life of Raquel pretty well. But we were going to podcast yesterday, and you were going to this cool thing. Tell me about this thing you were going to.
Yeah. So every year, there's this rock and mineral wholesaler they call Jewel Tunnel Imports. And they're usually just open for wholesale. Mm-hmm. But once a year, they open it to local geology students in the LA area, so that they can go and purchase rocks and minerals and fossils.
Oh, cool. And, so like learn from and to teach with.
Yeah.
Awesome.
As a way, because a lot of the geology groups at the different universities, one way that they raise money is by buying rocks and then selling them at school.
Oh, smart. And this so it's like your bake sales, but they're like nerd sales.
Yeah,
I
nerd
love
sales.
It.
It's
like
amazing.
Nerdy rock sales.
Yes, yes. Awesome. So every year they do this, which is really amazing. They open up the entire, it's 10,000, over 10,000 square feet of boxes and
oh my God.
And display
cases. Is it like
cases.
Overwhelming?
It is. But this year they reorganized everything by color.
Oh, neat.
So all of the shelves, everything was by color. So you know, if you know what a mineral is going to look like,
you
know the color it's going to be. So it was really nice. And I actually got you something from there.
Shut up.
I did. Oh. I did. So.
Did you hear me yelp just then? I'm so excited.
I know you're not crazy about rocks, but your birthday is in October.
It is.
Right. So
yeah.
That means that your birthstone is opal,
I believe. It is opal.
So I got you an opal from Australia.
Oh my gosh, that's so cool.
So there
I
you go.
I actually love opals. I think they're one of the oh, that's beautiful. I think that they're one of the prettiest stones. Is that what you call it? Like a semi-precious stone?
Yeah.
I think that there's like different words
for
them. Because they're so, do you know why they look the way that they look? Because they have all these great it's like a hologram almost.
It is, yeah. So the why opal looks that way, so it's mostly, it's silica, mm-hmm. so the same stuff from quartz.
Okay.
But there's water in there. It's mixed in with water.
And so it makes like a lensing effect with it.
And so that's what you're getting.
That's so cool. Yeah, because there's different like greens and pinks and reds, and then sometimes, what do they call them, like fire opals when they're like really bright.
Yeah.
And then otherwise they're kind of this pretty like milky white with all these little, almost like holograms.
Yeah.
Like these little.
Anyways,
thank you.
There you go.
This is so pretty.
Oh, you're welcome.
You know what's so funny? I actually have a little bit of a collection of gems with my jewelry. I have some fossils on my shelves, all legally purchased, by the way.
Good.
And small, and fossils that have less of a significance to sign, like trilobites and things like that. Mm-hmm. But my mom is a really big gem collector. Mm. So, and she's really into flea markets. And so for my birthday and Christmas most years, I'll get like a really cool piece of vintage jewelry that has
amazing.
Some sort of weird jewel in it. And she's like read all up on it. I know, it's really fun. It's kind of a sort of a family tradition, I guess we could call it. So this is so great. I'm going to add it to my collection.
Yay.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm glad you like it.
Shoot. I'm all smiley now. Well, Raquel, this was so much fun. But before we go, I have to like grill you and be a jerk because I have everybody answer the same two questions at the end of the podcast.
Uh-oh.
And ask you the same two. And they're kind of big picture questions, so don't be overwhelmed. You can answer them in whatever context matters to you. But the first one is, when you think about the future, what is the thing that keeps you up at night most, that you're most kind of nervous about or that worries you the most? And on the flip side, what is the thing that you're most excited for and hopeful for?
The thing I'll start with a good.
Okay. Oh, interesting. All right. Switching it up. Yeah.
We're advancing so much technologically, mm-hmm. and I think we'll have the ability to solve a lot of the world problems in the future. And I think, I don't know what those solutions are going to be, but I'm really hopeful that they will be there.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I'm the most scared about is things that might hinder that process, that natural progression of technology, either politicians not wanting technology to advance for some reason, one reason or another, or religion, or anything that would hinder that progress is what scares me the most.
And isn't that the sad thing, is that that is what's going to hinder? You know, we think about, we've seen it where there's a new drug or a new tool, and it could be produced cheaply, it could be produced en masse, yet to turn a profit, or because it goes against some sort of cultural or religious or geopolitical thing, mm-hmm. that there's legislation that hinders it, that there are trade routes that are blocked, or, you know, because of war, because of control, like mm-hmm. control of the people, that we actually see that sometimes something that should be easy is just not as easy as it should be,
right.
Which is, yeah, really disheartening. But also, I think the more globally connected we are, the more that, you know, somebody from, like I said, Saudi Arabia can listen to the podcast mm-hmm. and have ideas, you know, the more that I can watch a YouTube video from somebody in Uganda who's telling me about their story, I think the more that we will hopefully as a people push back against that and really take some of that control back from especially, you know, oligarchies or plutocracies or, you know, governmental setups where the people are not at the center. Oh my God, I sound like a total communist. Ah, love it. A socialist, I mean, not a communist. People don't get scared. Raquel, this was so much fun.
Yeah, this was awesome. Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited
much fun.
That you
I was
were
really
able
nervous, but.
No, shut up. I couldn't tell. I honestly couldn't tell. You guys tweet to Raquel and tell her you couldn't tell. Oh, how do they tweet to you?
At Raquel Nuno.
Raquel Nuno, that's easy.
Yep.
And then is that your main place? Are you more into like this? I never even asked people at Snapchat because I'm like not on it, so I'm a jerk. I don't know if you're more on like Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat. Like, what's the best place?
I'm more of an Instagram person.
You're an Instagram person. Okay.
I love posting pictures and I love looking at other people's pictures.
Perfect. So what's your Instagram?
It's Keldera. So like Q U E L D E R A. And so where that comes from? So Caldera, because it's a volcano that mm-hmm. then sinks. So then I just changed it to be the ending of my name, Raquel. But so it's Caldera.
Cute.
Nerdy.
It's really nerdy. it's like a volcanic crater. But then I love it. And how can people learn more about SciComHub?
Yeah, so they can check out the website, psychomhub.com, and there's resources there. And we also have a Twitter. It's psychom_hub.
Ooh, I'm going to go there, and I just click follow.
Yay. Thank you.
Of course. Well, this was so much fun. Thank you for joining me. I learned a lot. I feel like I know you oh so well now.
Yay.
And guys, reach out to Raquel. You can, especially if you are someone who took a non-traditional route too. You know, it's always interesting, I think, to hear other people's stories.
Oh, I'd love that. Yeah. Yeah.
And
to hear that.
And to hear when somebody's story really resonates. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And check out Psychom Hub because they're doing Psychom Hub. Why is that so hard for us to say right now? It's because it's late.
It's late.
Check out Psychom Hub. They're doing some really cool stuff. Ooh, augmented reality sandbox. Okay, I'm going to go so I can look at this website. Guys, thanks for joining me week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.